This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, can the Prime Minister secure the ongoing industrial relations ceasefire he's seeking as a cornerstone of the economic recovery plans he's begun to unveil? Scott Morrison also wants funding for vocational education tied to performance. At least one state would sign up in return for more cash. And 3 years after Indigenous Australians proposed recognition in the Constitution, proponents enlist a high-profile PR firm to re-energise their push.
We need to really understand the thinking of the people of Australia. We need to understand what resonates with them and try and connect the story, the vision, the hope of the Uluru Statement to everyday Australians.
Well, plans for a post-COVID economic recovery are beginning to take more definite shape after a major speech today from the Prime Minister. Changes to the industrial relations landscape are first cab off the rank and in a sweetener to the unions before anyone sits down to a new process of talks. Scott Morrison has taken the government's union-busting laws off the table. It has echoes of the accord process during the Hawke years. So let's dive in first with our political reporter Tom Eagledon, who's in Canberra. Hello, Tom. The Prime Minister has laid out some of what's set to be a pretty sweeping plan for economic recovery that we'll get in stages, it seems. Why is industrial relations a top priority?
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it, in a way, because industrial relations really was not on the political agenda much before the COVID crisis, Linda. But like everything else, this crisis has upended that discussion. The pressure really is now on the government to streamline the economy for what is going to be some pretty rough waters ahead, or as the Prime Minister said today, to make the boat go faster as we try and traverse those waters. Now, he did talk about all sorts of things to do that in his speech today, including tax, and it'll be interesting to see the details of that one when he gets round to announcing them. But he did go into detail about a couple of other things that you've mentioned there yourself. Now, skills training is one of them. There's been a huge crisis in that sector in the private end of it. Meanwhile, TAFE colleges have been going backwards. The PM says that's because the system is too complex. It's unaccountable, and that it's not properly focused on getting a job for people doing those courses. So he's proposing what's called an activity-based funding model. That's very similar to the hospital funding model that the federal government has in place with the state, something that was put in by the Rudd government not quite 10 years ago. But look, returning to what you said at the top there, the main game here really is industrial relations. Now, business groups have liked what they've seen during the COVID crisis from unions in terms of everything from penalty rates to how casuals are working. And unions say they've been happy to help during that period on a temporary basis. Now, the PM is really hoping that that could be the start of a beautiful new friendship.
If you thought the last couple of months was hard, you ain't seen nothing yet, says the Prime Minister.
It will not be business as usual. Opening up will be harder than closing down.
The main problem is easy to grasp.
The overwhelming priority of this reset will be to win the battle for jobs.
And the solution has a new name you're going to hear a lot more about in the months ahead.
We need a job maker plan for a new generation of economic success.
And a new era of industrial relations, says the Prime Minister, one that leverages off the cooperation between unions and employers seen over the course of the COVID crisis.
And we now need to turn that into cooperation to create even more jobs, especially during this all-important recovery phase. Our current system is not fit for purpose.
He's asked the Industrial Relations Minister, Christian Porter, to convene a series of working groups between unions and employers, looking at simplifying awards, making enterprise agreements easier to negotiate, better defining casual and contract worker conditions, compliance and agreements for new industries. A plan's due to be produced by September, a month before the budget.
The first step is to get everyone back in the room, to bring people together. That's our job. And in particular, that's my job. We've booked the room, we've hired the hall, we've got the table ready.
And as a sign of good faith, he's dropped legislation the government drafted years ago to crack down on union misbehaviour, one that he was having difficulty getting through the Senate anyway.
In good faith, we've decided that the government will not pursue a further vote in the Senate on its Ensuring Integrity Bill.
We welcome the shelving of the Ensuring Integrity Bill. And sure, it's a good thing to get people around the table. But I can tell you there's a lot more to industrial relations than simply booking the room.
That's Deputy Opposition Leader Richard Marles, who's approaching today's pronouncements from the Prime Minister with caution.
The idea that a Liberal government is about to engage in industrial relations reform will send a chill down the spine of every Australian worker. We do need to be bringing Australians together at this moment, but this is a government and a Prime Minister that has been more responsible for pulling Australians apart than any other.
But ACTU Secretary Sally McManus is taking a more conciliatory tone. She's welcoming the offer to down weapons and talk and the goodwill gesture from the Prime Minister.
Unfortunately, in our country, for the last 20 years, there's been too much focus on union bashing and it has become a ritual and we're glad to see it stop.
But she says the government's new job maker plan shouldn't come at the expense of winding up its job keeper and job seeker payments.
If they still persist on wanting to stop it at the end of September, that will be just disastrous for so many working people. Also, JobSeeker should never go back to what it was.
Business groups, meanwhile, seem very satisfied with what the government's put on the table today, which they're interpreting as an attempted return to the days of the Accord in the early and mid-80s, a time of relative industrial peace. Jennifer Westacott is the Chief Executive of the Business Council of Australia.
If the enterprise agreement system went back to the original thinking of the Hawke and Keating government, where employees and employers were sitting down together, how do we make this business more successful, more productive? How can we expand? How can we get into new markets? How do we become more efficient? We know from history that that system created higher wages.
The Business Council of Australia's Jennifer Westacott. Tom Eagledon, our reporter in Canberra. Well, as Tom mentioned, the other leg of the PM's speech today is skills and training. He's described the current system as clunky and unresponsive, and he's pitching for more accountability as well as responsiveness to the skills that business needs. And he's flagged more money, possibly, if states come on board. Well, it seems the vocational education system is in such poor shape that none of the major players deny the need for change, as Annie Guest has found.
20-year-old Jamie Lee Crawford feels lucky to study a fully subsidised horticulture course at TAFE after leaving school knowing exactly what she wanted to do.
So my path was quite easy, just because I always knew what I wanted to do, so I just jumped online and started to apply.
But she doesn't believe her experience is typical.
Yeah, I have a few friends that have found it quite difficult to navigate and being able to afford to pay it.
So what do they do then?
So they then generally just look for a cheaper course to study.
Rather than the one that they...
Yeah, rather than the one that they actually wanted to do, yeah.
Some divert to courses at university when, as the Prime Minister opined, they're better suited to vocational education. He wants trade and skills elevated to a student's, quote, first best option, well up from the 20% who enter vocational education from school currently. But the cost of an advanced diploma can be...
Often you are paying $7,000 out of pocket to be able to do that.
The Chief Executive of TAFE Directors Australia, Craig Robertson, also readily acknowledges that among the 1,400 qualifications on offer, the same nursing or other course can cost different amounts in different states. He says prices are largely influenced by state governments and industry, and the course direction is also largely out of the hands of the TAFEs too.
Industry has really been driving the curriculum for VET for the last 10 to 15 years, and this is the point that we've got to. I think what's happened is we've ended up being so trying to be so specific about the needs of a particular job that it's become very, very complex to deliver against, and in fact, very, very costly.
One of the things that you want is almost a baseline curriculum. What do you mean, and why is it needed?
In that process, you get all of the base requirements that you need, whether you need literacy, numeracy, digital skills, but you also learn about your industry.
So that when technological advancements swallow jobs, they have the skills to help them transition to another job. TAFE Directors Australia largely welcomes the Prime Minister's plan for performance-based funding, and they want an equal say in the future of vocational education in the new National Skills Commission. Business also welcomes the new direction. Here's the Australian Industry Group's Megan Lilly.
The announcement about funding reform and actually looking at getting national efficiency prices and activity-based funding is indeed welcome and long overdue. That's been the major impediment to actually clarifying and improving and, in fact, streamlining the vocational education and training system. So we're very pleased to see that happen. We're not naive. It will be a very big piece of work, but an incredibly important threshold piece of work to be undertaken. But, of course, we would like to see some qualifications to be reformed. There's a new Australian qualification framework that has been revised and now needs to be implemented.
Meanwhile, at least one state has indicated it would sign up for funding tied to performance in vocational education, but it calls on the Commonwealth to provide far more than the current $1.5 billion in annual national funding. The Queensland Minister for Training and Skills Development is Shannon Fentanyl.
Queensland has nothing to be afraid of if it's tied to outcomes and activities.
How much more do the states want in exchange for signing up to this tied funding?
If we are going to see more students enrolled in VET and more apprentices and trainees, we're going to need significantly more than what we're getting right now.
The latest plans follow years of reviews, including by the Productivity Commission. But with broad agreement, there's optimism the vocational education sector may now get the changes it needs.
Annie Guest reporting from Brisbane. Well, despite Australia's low rate of COVID-19 cases, there are daily reminders that the virus is still out there, requiring our continued vigilance. Today we've learned that six crew members on a live export ship that docked in the port of Fremantle in WA have tested positive for coronavirus, and now there are questions around the authorisation for it to dock. In South Australia, the first case in 19 days has been recorded in a returning traveller granted a quarantine exemption. And continuing across the continent to New South Wales, two Sydney schools are closed because of positive cases, just a day after the state's pupils went back to classrooms full time. Gavin Coote has been taking a look.
Tuesday morning's classes were just getting underway at Waverley College when parents were suddenly urged to come and pick their children back up. A Year 7 student at the Eastern Suburbs School had tested positive to COVID-19.
Someone was sick, that's all. I'm sure they're doing the right thing.
Someone's tested positive, so they've shut the school down.
I was expecting it, I guess.
It was a matter of hours before another school, about 5 minutes down the road, had confirmed a case. A Year 5 pupil had tested positive to COVID-19 at Maria College. It's only the second day back in the classroom full-time for students in New South Wales and Queensland. Following a lengthy stint of remote learning, other states are staggering the reopening of their schools. And New South Wales Education Minister Sarah Mitchell insists the COVID-19 cases that have emerged today aren't much to fuss about.
But I think parents should know that we do have good systems in place. We've got good processes that can protect their children, and it's something that we're going to have to live with.
These processes involve temporarily shutting down schools for cleaning and contact tracing while isolating the infected students. Maru Scheel, an infectious diseases epidemiologist with the Australian National University, thinks it's unlikely the virus will be completely eliminated. And she says it's all down to making sure there's no delay in responding to outbreaks.
I think that's a sign of a good public health response. And as long as we can do that, we can ensure that there's no increase in number of cases and transmission, propagation of new cases and ongoing transmission.
Yeah, that three-pronged approach, having a rapid closure of schools, deep cleaning and careful contact tracing, provided all those measures are taken, is there any reason we should expect that there will be that wide transmission within the school setting?
What we've seen so far from the original studies before all the school closures came in due to school holidays and then the staged approach of going back, of course, at the start, there were lots of concerns about what the role of schools is in the entire picture of transmission for COVID-19. And what we've learned so far is that schools or school-going children are not particularly at high risk or don't get severe disease. That doesn't mean that teachers are not at risk. So there are interventions in place that if you are elderly high risk, then you may consider.
Authorities in Western Australia are also moving quickly to contain an outbreak, with six crew members on board a ship testing positive with the virus. The ship carrying sheep has been docked at Fremantle Port since Friday. Infected crew members are disembarking and headed for quarantine in hotels at Perth. WA Premier Mark McGowan is now looking for answers on how it was allowed to dock.
The Police Commissioner has reached out to the Australian Border Force Commissioner and the Federal Department of Agriculture to try and get an understanding as to why the ship was allowed to berth at our port.
As the news of the WA outbreak filtered into Canberra, the Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy, was quizzed by Labor's Home Affairs spokeswoman, Christina Keneally, on how the Department of Agriculture handles reports of on-water COVID cases.
But just so we're clear, the reports go to Agriculture and then what, they get sent to Western Australia?
They will consult if they believe there is any... They've a whole range of protocols, and if they believe there are any human health risks, they are required to consult with the Director of Human Biosecurity in that state. Now, we are speculating about what has happened with this ship.
The Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy, Gavin Coote with that report. You're listening to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, is Beijing risking Hong Kong's financial riches as it plans to impose a new security law? One critic fears this moment marks the Communist Party's declaration of total control over the territory.
China is no longer the China of 1997 or, 1984 when the initial agreement was signed. It has a lot of other options. So Hong Kong may be a goose that lays golden eggs, but it's not the only goose anymore.
It's been 3 years since Indigenous Australians delivered to all Australians the Uluru Statement from the Heart, but it has made little tangible progress. So a new campaign aims to galvanise support for the central proposition, a constitutionally enshrined Indigenous voice to Parliament. The From the Heart campaign will feature high-profile voices from the Indigenous community. But behind the scenes, the global PR firm Crosby Texter, known for helping Scott Morrison and Tony Abbott, as well as Britain's David Cameron and Boris Johnson get into office, will be crafting the message. Oliver Gordon reports.
3 years ago, constitutional lawyer Megan Davis joined 350 other Indigenous leaders at Uluru.
In 1967, we were counted. In 2017, we seek to be heard.
The Uluru Statement from the Heart set out a path for reconciliation and a shared vision for the country's future. 3 years on, Professor Davis says that journey continues.
I think we are moving forward in the right direction. I think after the Uluru Statement from the Heart was issued, we saw it being put into a parliamentary committee, a joint select committee led by Julian Lisa and Patrick Dodson. And that committee, over the course of 2018, found in consultation with the Australian people and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community that the only viable option for meaningful recognition on the table was a constitutionally enshrined voice to Parliament.
Today, a campaign with that goal in mind was launched.
So let's come together, all speak from the heart, and make a real difference for our shared future.
The From the Heart campaign seeks to educate Australians as to what a voice to Parliament actually is. Dean Parkin is the campaign's director.
We think the time is right to really press hard on an education project with the people of Australia.
And you've enlisted the help of some big hitters in the PR political strategy world. Crosby Textor have helped Scott Morrison, David Cameron, Boris Johnson, Tony Abbott get elected. What expertise is this group offering your campaign?
We need to really understand the thinking of the people of Australia. We need to understand what resonates with them and try and connect the story, the vision, the hope of the Uluru Statement to everyday Australians. So we need some help. We need some help to understand through research what that looks like.
As the very public From the Heart campaign starts to roll out, behind the scenes, philanthropy is funding the movement too. Today, $1.25 million was awarded to the University of New South Wales by the Belknapes Foundation to fund a chair in constitutional law position for Megan Davis. Hamish Belknapes is the foundation's director.
There's a lot of work to do to keep the Uluru Statement alive. We're funding this chair to advance the work Megan and Davis is doing to achieve a constitutionally enshrined voice to Parliament, and that will require a referendum.
Professor Davis says she'll use her Belknapes funded position to dedicate more time to complex constitutional legal work and consultation needed to drive the voice to Parliament proposal forward.
Yeah, so since 2017, we've been working, around the clock with a number of constitutional lawyers, looking at the kinds of options for what an amendment might look like, what a ballot paper question might look like. It's a big piece of work that we've been doing for 3 years. And that work has, by and large, been a part of our daily work, but unfunded. And so this particular grant frees up, you know, a fair bit of time to push forward on a lot of the community legal education publications that are required to convey to the Australian people these reforms. That's really, I think, what the grant will be used for.
Professor Megan Davis, Oliver Gordon, our reporter. Well, we've been discussing the government's plans to reboot the economy, and some are urging the government to sort out the decade-long mess around energy policy as part of that. In a repositioning, the federal government last week switched focus from coal to gas in an energy paper it released, seeing gas as the means to ensure a reliable energy source in the transition to renewables. But has progress on renewables and battery storage already outrun the need for a transition technology? Could the country be backing the wrong horse? Nick Grimm reports.
Tape's on.
1 minute to start.
In a usually quiet corner of Sydney Harbour, a group of men gather regularly, drawn by the powerful combination of sun, wind and water to race their remote-controlled model yachts.
One.
This is what I call the men's shed on the water. As you can see from the people who are sailing here, they're all old sailors and that sort of thing.
And as Noel McPherson from the De Bruyde Aquatic Club tells me, batteries, and plenty of them, are the other important ingredient for these avid yachtsmen.
How long could a model boat like this sail for on a single set of batteries?
We could sail all day. Depends on the wind conditions.
Battery storage like that is the same problem facing anyone trying to harness Australia's abundant wind and solar energy. How to ensure that power is available when, as the saying goes, the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow? And as Australia's chief scientist, Alan Finkel, told the ABC's Q&A program last night, batteries aren't yet up to the task.
I think that if we just try to bring on a lot of solar and a lot of wind electricity and hydroelectricity, but solar and wind in particular, and rely only on battery storage to give it its firming, to make sure that we can dispatch energy when we need it, there will be a limited rate, given the availability and cost of batteries, there will be a limited rate at how fast we can develop solar and wind.
But energy generation is rapidly evolving. The demolition of chimneys at Victoria's now decommissioned Hazelwood Power Station, a powerful reminder that Australia's coal-fired power assets are ageing and increasingly unlikely to get renewed. And in a major shift, the federal government last week released its technology roadmap, overlooking coal while highlighting gas as a new priority for the economy. The fossil fuel is also endorsed by the chief scientist as a means of lowering the nation's carbon emissions.
And gas is effectively the perfect complement to solar and wind. We can build a lot of solar and a lot of wind and use gas for the times when we don't have the sunshine and the wind blowing, you know, to deliver the energy that we need.
But others disagree, like former Sydney Lord Mayor Lucy Turnbull. She warns Australia could end up pouring billions into an energy source that's dirtier and more expensive.
Well, I find that a little bit troubling because I think we have to have a national and a global goal of having net zero carbon by 2050 at the latest, ideally 2040. And the way to get there is to have renewables plus storage. Now, storage is not just batteries. You can have pumped hydro and battery. The battery technology revolution is really amongst us.
Professor Frank Yotso is the director of ANU's Centre for Climate Economics and Policy. He says renewables are the future, even if gas still has a role to play in the short term.
There's every risk that investing in a large-scale gas infrastructure expansion will mean wasting money in the long term. Wind and solar beat gas and new coal plants hands down, and the additional cost for storing that energy is actually not as great as the cost differential between running a gas plant and renewables plus storage. And so gas at large scale in future will simply not be economical.
Professor Frank Yotso is the director of the ANU's Centre for Climate Economics and Policy. Nick Grimm with that report. Well, Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, is trying to hose down fears for the city's freedoms as China's ruling Communist Party prepares to impose a new national security law, bypassing Hong Kong's own legislature and likely breaching the letter of the agreement for Hong Kong's status. She's urged that people wait to see the law, and she asserts that Hong Kong's freedoms will be safe. But opponents say if the law looks anything like that, which already applies on the mainland, those freedoms are dead. Wilfred Chan is a freelance writer from Hong Kong who's currently in New York. He penned a poignant piece about his city's fate for the publication The Nation this week. He maintains the new law marks a declaration of total authority over Hong Kong and its people by Beijing.
What we know is that the Chinese version of the national security law makes it practically impossible to dissent against the central government, to really speak your mind on a lot of political issues without paying a pretty heavy price.
However, Beijing's top diplomat has been out and about talking to diplomats and others in the city and saying, look, this law is aimed only at terrorists and at sedition, and it's going to secure the sort of peaceful rights of law-abiding citizens. The first post-handover chief executive, Tung Chee Hwa, has echoed that view, that Hong Kong needs this law.
Right.
Why is that not true?
Well, there's two parts here. The first thing is, if you look at the rhetoric that the Chinese government has been using against overwhelmingly peaceful protests, just an innocent demonstration asking for our basic rights could be considered treasonous or seditious acts under the Chinese Communist Party's definition. But I think the second part is not just the content of the law, but really the way that they introduce it. And when you look at how they actually announce this law unilaterally, that itself it's an expression of that authoritarian control.
What about the claim by Beijing that local and foreign businesses in Hong Kong have been concerned about the impact of the protests, that they need to restore stability for business reasons? Is that a legitimate claim?
I don't think so, because when you look at recent surveys, even amid the coronavirus pandemic, you have an overwhelming majority of the Hong Kong public supporting the protests. And this is after more than a year. If Beijing or the Hong Kong government were truly committed to having a good climate for business, they should have addressed these five demands, which are actually quite humble.
We also have the Hong Kong Bar Association saying that it can't see how Beijing has the power to add the national security law it proposes into Hong Kong's basic law. And it makes a very cogent sort of legal set of legal arguments about that. Do you think that case will have any impact on Beijing?
No, I don't think so, because Beijing knows full well that they're crossing all sorts of legal red lines, that they're contradicting all sorts of agreements that they themselves have agreed to, but who's going to stop them?
Over the weekend, there was an outcry internationally. 198 parliamentarians from 23 countries issued a statement saying this is a flagrant breach of the Sino-British Joint Declaration. Has the international community got enough clout here to be able to get Beijing to change its mind?
No, I don't think so. And when you look at what the U.S. has done, for example, which is to introduce the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, the central threat of that act is to no longer treat it as a special administrative region for the purposes of trade and finance and all these other things, but to treat it as part of China. Now, what China has done with this national security law is essentially call the bluff of efforts like the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Acts to say, you know what, we don't really care if you want to declare that Hong Kong is no longer a special place. If you want to just say that it's part of China, go ahead.
But there's an economic and financial reality here. Is China not killing the goose that lays the golden egg, to use that phrase, by going down this path?
Well, it is and it isn't. You know, you look at what China's doing with the Belt and Road Initiative, how it's cultivating Shenzhen and Shanghai as alternative centers of capital and global trade. So Hong Kong may be a goose that lays golden eggs, but it's not the only goose anymore. And I think the Communist Party has made the calculation that it's more trouble than it's worth right now. It's a really, really sad time.
Wilfred Chan, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much.
Hong Kong writer Wilfred Chan, and a longer reflection with Wilfred if you head to the PM webpage. I'm Linda Mottram, and that's PM. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Do not forget to subscribe and leave us a review while you're there. See you later.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Angela Poirier, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. COVID-19 is focusing attention on government debt. But what if the way we think about that problem is totally wrong?
Today on The Signal, we're looking into the radical new economic theory that's become known as modern monetary policy. We're asking how it works, whether it would cause chaos and hyperinflation, and how it might apply to Australia's current coronavirus crisis. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.